As I mentioned, this session, Lifeline, helping your advisors build a business. Practice management has been an area that that the Marketing Council has talked quite a bit about and how we can deliver additional value to the attendees to this conference and give you actionable information on how to provide the support to your advisors that they want, that they expect. And so I think we've got a couple of real pros on our panel today. To my immediate right is Mark Schoenbeck, who is the Chief Marketing Officer and Director of Practice Management for Genworth Financial Wealth Management. And then on the end here is David Patchen, who's a Regional Director for Raymond James. Both of them have an extensive background in the industry, and both of them have been on each side of the fence as a producer and on the home office side. So I think they're going to have some outstanding insights to share with us today. And so I'm going to let them take it from here. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. It's that first morning session in the Big Easy. Glad to see such a great turnout. I think I'll try to speak for both of us here. When we were talking about this session and how we wanted to hold this session, one thing that we both were pretty passionate about was that we want this to be as interactive as possible. So as two people that are used to getting up in front of crowds and engaging them, interaction is a huge thing to making this session successful for all of you. So you had choices on where you wanted to be this morning. There were some other speakers with some pretty big names and credentials and all that kind of fun stuff. So you're here for a reason. I think for the two of us, we really would want to start this session out from hearing from you. Why are you here? What will make this meeting a useful use of our hour and 8 minutes that we have left? So we'll throw it out, and we're good at picking on people if nobody volunteers. So why are you here? All right. Dan, why are you here? That's what happens when you sit in the front row. You get picked on first.
I think we all believe that the combination of practice management and helping advisors understand and utilize quality practice management initiatives are definitely help build loyalty and are very valuable to advisors, whether they're incredibly successful or trying to be. And I was very interested to hear how you both were going to position the use of practice management in helping advisors to, number one, actually see a great presentation or hear about the services and then actually incorporate it into their business and hold them accountable to incorporating the great feedback you give them into their business.
Yeah, so for those that might not have heard that, I think the key things that I took out of that is accountability, integration. How do you give a great presentation? How do you do all of that to build loyalty with your advisors? That's great. Anybody else?
Also, you mentioned understanding and utilization, which are additional points that we're going to touch on. So
yep,
you hit
absolutely
quite a few right there, Dan.
All right, somebody in the back. There we go. Thanks.
Specific ideas,
specifically around anybody else?
No, I just had one other thing that it would be nice if the whole conversation wasn't focused around dealing with compliance. It's like everything once you get past that, because it's so obvious in today's world. What other things? Profitability. How do you spend your time? What's the best way in this world to succeed?
Well, that's encouraging, Dan, because none of my comments have anything to do with compliance.
And while I'm married to a compliance person, neither do my comments. I get enough compliance at home. What else? There's another hand that's popping up in the back.
My comment would be, I think there's probably three big sleeves to make a net contribution or profit margin for everyone who owns an IBD, right? Obviously recruiting, obviously keeping financial advisors happy, and then the third one is helping grow the revenue. And we as leaders of independent broker-dealers have to find a way to help them drive and grow that revenue so we can become more profitable and they can become happier. So this is, to me, a key part.
What is your name?
Craig Abram, Wells Fargo Advisors.
Craig?
Okay.
Great. Yes. Yeah.
And they aren't really jumping in and fully utilizing what we're offering.
Yep. Cut their pay out. We'll talk about technology and adoption. Absolutely. What else? A lot of people in the back there. There's a reason why you're here. Why are you here? We realize it's early in the morning.
To couple onto that last statement, buy-in, getting the advisors to understand what they don't know. The reality of it is, we look at 2009, right? Advisors were looking for some direction. So practice management is something that everybody talks about, but do they truly understand what it is and do they buy into the concept?
Right. Excellent. Okay, so I think that's a good starting point. I think the good news is that most of what was requested we will cover at some point. Again, we want this to be interactive, so please stop us at any point along the way. Ask questions. If there's something that we're not sharing that you want more info on, please stop it. I think from a high-level framework, we're going to kind of go back and forth here and pass the mic, but we are going to talk about first, why do we have practice management in our organizations, and it's some of the rationale for the money, time, energy that we spend as organizations supporting this initiative. So we'll talk a little bit for why, and maybe, Dave, you can give the quick overview of what you guys do so everybody has an idea there as a part of that. We'll get into some of the challenges. So, the win-win-win concept makes sense and everybody gets it, but delivering effective communication or practice management has its challenges, so we'll both kind of share our experiences from a challenges perspective, and then we'll wrap up the session sharing with you just some broad-level suggestions. So as you're looking to work on your practice management initiatives, some things to keep in mind. Just out of curiosity, because we didn't get everybody asking a question, how many people in the room, show of hands, have some sort of practice management offering today in their organization? So maybe half the room. How many people have actual dedicated staff, somebody on staff that you're paying solely focused on practice management? Okay, even fewer. Okay, great. All right, so I'll turn it over to you, Dave, to take us away.
Sounds great. Craig, you made some really astute observations. To just give you a little background about how we do it at Raymond James and how it came about, I really was somewhat of an individual catalyst, and I don't want this session nor the Raymond James program to be about me. However, in our case, somebody needed to take the reins and run with it. And in consideration of, and interestingly enough, do you know Kent Christian?
Very well.
Okay, well, Kent was my supervisor back then. He left Raymond James and went to what was then Wachovia, now Wells Fargo. And Kent was actually having a difficult time, you can tell him I said that, he'll take it tongue-in-cheek, with getting Dick Averett, our CEO for RJFS, which is the independent contractor division of Raymond James. He was getting a tough time getting Dick's commitment for us to actually spend money on practice management. So my presentation, Kent asked me to, make a business case for us devoting resources to practice management. And I used exactly the revenue streams and my predicted income on those revenue streams that Craig described. And they are, obviously, same-store sales. Can we impact same-store sales in a meaningful way? Recruiting is another area where I felt with proper integration, promotion of what we were doing, it could have an impact on recruiting. And then the third, which I think a lot of firms overlook, is the valuable resources that we call them partner firms, some other broker-dealers call them sponsor firms. The mutual fund annuity companies out there have tons of resources, Mark's firm being a great example, and there's underutilization of those resources. So could we really have an impact in all three of those areas? And obviously with revenue sharing, there's quite a bit of that's really our third tier revenue stream in the independent broker-dealer space. So we felt like if we could impact those, you know, roughly $1 billion a year in revenue is our top line, you know, if we could even have a 3-5% impact, you're talking about a $30-50 million a year impact on our business. So what we did was build a model, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit more when I talk about content, content sharing, organization. I think all of us would agree there's lots of great stuff out there. There's lots of great stuff that firms like Mark's and some of yours provide. There's great resources that some of the departments in the home offices of our firms provide. Those of you that have clearing arrangements that are fully disclosed, those firms, those clearing firms, the Pershings, the Fidelities have great resources. So it's not about stuff. It's about being able to find stuff. So we built a model. It was actually something that, a derivation of something that I had seen at a Dun & Bradstreet seminar, free public seminar that I went to 15 years ago now. And basically, I will tell you that the reason it has worked well is because it is intuitive, not only to financial advisors, and very simply, it's a four-quadrant model. It follows the natural life cycle of a client relationship. So first thing you have to do is find somebody. That's the marketing, positioning, prospecting quadrant. Next thing you have to do is consider a relationship with them. And this is something that Scott West from Van Kampen helped us with. When Scott looked at our model, he said you could make this a lot simpler by really reducing each quadrant to one word. So quadrant one was find. Find people to talk to. Quadrant two is consider. And that's when the advisor is considering whether they want this person to be a new client to their practice. And the client is considering whether they want to work with this advisor and have them manage their financial future. So that's all of the diagnostic work that an advisor does, the various meetings that they have. That's quadrant two, consider. Quadrant three is delight. So quadrant three assumes that they now are a client. And that's the relationship management, relationship deepening, referral garnering quadrant, so to speak. That's quadrant three. And then the final quadrant, interestingly enough, when I was designing this model, I really got to 9 o'clock and really didn't have anything left. But we had, this was 7 years ago, and we had just started with the data warehouse at Raymond James, where we were taking all of the cumulative transactions, production fees, commissions, and we were starting to dissect that data. So I figured, why not make, since independent contractor advisors are independent business owners, small business owners, why not make quadrant four the refine quadrant? So that is, in Gerber speak, those of you that are eMyth fans, and you should be if you're not, that book is now given to our recruits when they come in the door. That's working on the business rather than in the business. And what we've done over time, talking about evolution, some of where it's going, is not only is quadrant four the business owner's quadrant, but it's also the life quadrant. We put a lot of fun stuff in there, you know, health, exercise, nutrition, anything that makes you better as an advisor, business owner, working with staff, all of that. And you all know these are major issues with business owners, stuff that we're not intimately involved in because they're not employee advisors, but certainly stuff they want support on, ideas on, that's really quadrant four. So that's what we did, what we've done. I will tell you, and since this is recorded, I have to be careful. You know, I still have some frustration about adoption firm-wide, promotion firm-wide. You know, in a large organization like Raymond James, the beauty is that it's entrepreneurial and they let, you know, me initially and others build this and run with it. The challenge is that within a large organization, there are people that, for their own reasons and their own silo protections, don't want your initiative to move forward or aren't going to support it as much as they could. So there's a lot, there's a whole nother I'd want to caution those of you in mid and large size firms to be cognizant of, a whole nother level of, you know, inter-firm, inter-corporate politicking that's required so that there's as much mutual buy-in and benefit as possible.
So I think from my perspective, kind of on the why practice management, and the 32nd for me is that I spent 5 years on a pretty large broker-dealer in which we, as a part of our efforts, started a pretty large and successful coaching program for our advisors, and then have transitioned to the quote-unquote product side of the world to kind of carry this practice management torch. And for me, regardless of what side of the world I was on, there's a certain level of commoditization that's taking place in our industry. So if I'm putting on my broker-dealer hat, we're all kind of in the same ballpark from a payout perspective. We're all using the same clearing firms. We're all pulling from the same list of third-party providers, and we all try to take technology and tweak it and make it unique, and we all have our unique value proposition. But when you take a real good, cold, hard look at it, there's a lot of similarities there. So back in the broker-dealer world, for me, it was, you know, ultimately we are in a relationship business. It's something that I talk about all of the time. And if you really want to demonstrate a level of commitment to that relationship, you had to come up with sort of a win-win proposition. And it's real simple. It's basic. Somebody alluded to it earlier. If you're a broker-dealer and you're working with advisors and product companies, it's a win-win-win to make your advisors more productive. If your advisors become more productive and sell more, that's going to raise their revenue, which is a win for them. It's going to raise the revenue of your organization, which is a win for your group. And then, obviously, the third-party firms that you're choosing to do business with are going to get reward in that process as well. So kind of key fundamental is that focus of, hey, you know what, this is an effort that's going to raise everybody's boats. In that, for the other part of it, and what you've seen, so I've kind of watched this evolution of practice management kind of come into favor over the years, is that you're seeing a lot more people kind of give it lip service, and you're hearing more people say, oh, we do practice management, we do practice management. But for me, it's always kind of the look under the hood, and is it really just lip service, or is there something really there? And I think if I'm, again, putting my broker-dealer hat on, the more things that you actually can deliver in a tangible way, and then to package those in a way that reminds advisors how much you're actually giving them, is a really kind of fundamental part of the offering. Because a lot of us, I would guess, if we go out to your websites and dig around long enough, are going to find a lot of great resources. You probably have links to other firms and Excel spreadsheets and tools and all sorts of great stuff, but burying content in a website is not going to be that in-your-face reminder at an individual advisor level that you as an organization are making a very strong commitment. So from our perspective at Genworth Financial Wealth Management, there's a lot that we do to try to proactively stay in front of the advisors. So on a quarterly basis, we do 13 meetings all across the country. In addition to those, we'll do 10 two-and-a-half-day meetings. And those meetings are publicized in almost everything that we do. It's really important for us to continually be reminding our advisors that these resources are there. We do little things. So, you know, we have a sales force of 37 people that typically most of us would consider them wholesalers. We don't call them wholesalers. We call them regional consultants. So you have to look. So I get the benefit of wearing two hats. I get to wear the marketing hat and the practice management hat. From a marketing perspective, you have to think about how you are packaging your overall offering to create this feeling and sense that everything you're doing is really driving toward helping them build a better business, to have that win-win-win type of model, and to have that tangible demonstration, right? Those meetings are tangible. There's advisors sitting in the room. They're seeing the level of commitment and the money as an organization that you are spending to put those sort of things on. And then ultimately, again, I you know, one of the disclaimers for me is that I believe everything that we do in this business is relationship-oriented. Advisors choose to join your firm because of some sort of relationship that you're creating with them in that recruiting process. They're staying with your firm because they're building relationships with home offices and the staff and the people that they're interacting with. And I'm an ultimate believer that people choose products based upon relationships, right? You might have the greatest website. You might have the greatest technology in the world. If there's not some sort of human relationship taking place there, The retention's not going to be there. The recruiting's not going to be there. And for me, when I think about practice management, there isn't any better way to build a lasting relationship with an advisor than by making a marked impact on their business. And those relationships are lifelong. So, you know, I go back to my broker-dealer days and similar type of conversation where you're making the case to the executive team on, hey, we want to spend some money and do some things here. And there's a lot of, yeah, I don't know, kind of skepticism about it. And it didn't take very long to where we had, you know, our kind of first group of people who were going through the coaching program have some pretty profound stories and experiences. You know, advisors who had come to a meeting and we had been talking about putting systems and processes in your business and documenting what your staff does. And, you know, one of the advisors went back and took it to heart and got their team totally engaged, and it took them about 6 months, but they put processes in place for everything in their business. And it happened about 6 months later that the advisor's number one employee, his kind of key staff person, came in and said, you know what, I'm quitting. I've always wanted to live in California. I'm quitting 2 weeks' notice. I'm out of here. Right, so what would have been an extremely stressful situation for most of our advisors to lose that number one staff person was really, in a lot of ways, a non-event, because they had taken the time to implement something that we as an organization had given them. And we got a letter back from this advisor saying, and it was like 2 pages, and it was the ultimate, I can't thank you enough. You guys have, you know, helped save my business, improve my business. And the cool thing about it was that the person quit, and he had a couple other staff people, and because they had documented everything so well, they didn't hire a certain another person. So the end of the letter goes, and most importantly, I just want you to know that you added $50,000 to my bottom line. And the loyalty that that created, I still talk to that advisor today, like two or three companies later. We still talk today. It's that relationship glue, that tangible demonstration that, you know what, we really do, and we're not giving it lip service. We really do care about you and your success, and we've made commitments to make that happen. And that, to me, is the ultimate why, right? Ultimately, we're all in this business and running businesses to make money. You have to have sales. You have to have production. But that production, retention, all of that is driven around the relationships that you have, and those relationships, in my perspective, are really solidified through an effective delivery of practice management. So before we kind of move on to the next session, or next part of this, any questions around the why, the how? You know, we both individually kind of reference having to sell it to an organization. Is anybody having that conversation? Any questions on that?
Yeah, silence. I'm certainly going to go more in depth into the how. I'm going to give you, from our perspective, some specifics, suggestions, guidance, you know, in the coming slides. Nope.
All right. So let's talk about challenges then. The first one I have up here is commitment versus hobby. So you read the trade publications, you kind of see what's taking place, and a lot of people like to use the word practice management. I think when we look at most of our recruiting efforts, at some form or fashion, whether we call it practice management or not, we're trying to include that as a part of our value proposition. And from my perspective, having one been on your side of the table, but now having worked with many of you on this side of the table, one of the things that I think you really have to examine as an organization is this truly a commitment, or is this a hobby? Is it a commitment, or is it a hobby? Because one of the things, I'll cover it a little bit later from a suggestions perspective, is that where I have seen practice management be most successful is where it is truly integrated into the culture of the organization. That the principles that you're using to drive content from a practice management perspective have to permeate everything that you do, from operations to compliance to sales to down to your meetings, right? Do you have good old traditional meetings where you just bring a bunch of us up and let us talk about what we want? Or do you have very focused, strategic thoughts about what do we want our advisors walking away from this meeting with? And ultimately, at the end of the day, a lot of that comes down to principles of practice management. So you have to be committed to it. You can't just say, we're going to do a little bit here and a little bit there, see how it works, and stick with it. It's, to me, and it's fascinating now being more on the marketing side, it's the same principle that we train our advisors on, Right? How many of you have had advisors that have gone to some workshop presentation by some coach or marketing guru? They drop $5,000 or $6,000. They think it's going to solve all of their problems. They go home, they try it once, and now they have a closet full of audio business cards in their closet. Right? We've all had those. Well, the reason that those people are failing in some of those efforts is not because the ideas themselves are bad. It's the consistency in which they're being delivered. They try it once. It didn't produce some great, overwhelming result. And they go, that didn't work. We got to go find the next silver bullet. We see that happen a lot with organizations from a practice management perspective. There has to be a commitment to integrating different types of content, different delivery of content throughout the organization and everything that you're doing. Content creation. What's fascinating to me, and this is, if I can share one sort of thing to think about. Practice management to me is not about the content that you deliver. Practice management is truly about changing behavior. So one of my favorite quotes is Albert Einstein's definition of insanity: doing the same thing over and over and over, expecting to get a different result. And that is our advisors, right? They've hit some level of success in their business, doing whatever it is that they were doing, and for some reason, they want to take it to a new level, whatever that means to them. More revenue, more free time, different business, whatever that might mean. But they keep hitting this roadblock, right? And the conversation we have with them is say, look, if you want a different result, you have to do something different. How many people in the room think that change is easy? It's not. And our advisors are no different. So for me, practice management really is about how do you get a grown adult, type A typically, highly opinionated, probably pretty successful person to change their ways and to change their behavior. Everything that I think about from a practice management perspective comes down to how can we change behavior? Because from a content creation perspective, anybody can find enough information on the 80-20 rule. We've all heard presentations around referral marketing. We've all talked about how do you pay staff and giving them org charts and job descriptions and have done all of that. But unless you can get them to take that information and change their behavior, it really is all for naught. And that is the, you know, and unfortunately, I don't have the answer to the silver bullet, but your focus when you're thinking about practice management should first and foremost be how are we going to change the behavior of the people that we're doing, which to me comes to content delivery. Dumping a bunch of stuff on your website is not going to get it done. It's just not. Right? We're in a relationship business. People want that one-on-one interaction. So from our perspective, the content delivery turns out to be one of the more expensive components of the process, but it has to be face-to-face. So again, we'll do 10 2.5-day workshops in front of 100 advisors per meeting. We do 13 one-day workshops all across the country, typically 30 to 60 advisors in each of those meetings. It has to be that one-on-one interaction. Again, it demonstrates the tangible nature of what it is that you're trying to do, but it's that one-on-one accountability, and we'll talk about it again, when I go through some suggestions, but one way that you can change behavior is by building in accountability. And one of the easy ways to get accountability between advisors is make them compete against each other. They are a competitive group of people, and if you can find creative ways to challenge them to beat the person sitting next to them, it's a pretty powerful tool in the arsenal. So from a content delivery perspective, it's face-to-face groups. It's face-to-face one-on-one. You have to have that one-on-one interaction because that's really where a lot of the change takes place. And I keep kind of poo-pooing dumping stuff on a website, but you do need online resources as well. And you think about the technology that's coming out today and the resources that we have there. We're looking today at video conferencing and Skype. More and more advisors have video in their offices. There's some pretty cool, creative learning tools where you can do video sitting at your desk where you have a shared screen between your video and your desktop. So we're really trying to leverage technology to kind of create a more human interface in the delivery of the content versus just dropping stuff on slides and on a website. And then the last one, and this to me is probably the hardest one that throughout my career has always been a challenge, is tracking the results. I'm in an organization that came out of a GE heritage, so everything needs to be tracked and analyzed, and if you can't draw a direct line from this activity to this result, the engineers in the home office have a hard time putting their heads around that. And the challenge with practice management is that it's tough to draw that straight line to the impact and to the result. There is a leap of faith as an organization that you have to make to say, look, if we are really truly trying to make our advisors better, that result will come back to us, whether or not we can draw a direct line to that result. So I'll give you a real life example. I was having this conversation a couple of years ago where, you know, you look at the budgets of what it costs to put on these meetings and to hire people who are educated in practice management enough to go out and represent you well, and it adds up fairly quickly, and the executive team usually sits back and says, well, how much sales lift am I going to get out of it? How much production as a broker-dealer am I going to get out of that? And what's the typical answer is to say, okay, we'll take a snapshot of the production of all the people that went through some program that we put on, and we'll come back a quarter from now or 6 months from now or a year from now, and we'll take another snapshot of their production. And if you really believe in what you're saying, Mark, then production should go up from point A to point B. Ideally, that's the case, but do we know that that's the reality of it? So in our world, the challenge that we have is that we could bring one of your advisors to one of the best 2 days that they've ever spent in their career from a practice management perspective, but if our regional consultant goes out the following week and they don't get along and they don't build a relationship, it's gone, right? And it's not an effect of the practice management, it's an effect of that. Same sort of thing. Let's say that they have a great relationship with our regional consultant and our back office loses the first big client check or puts it in the wrong account or something goes wrong, right? There's a gazillion ways that those kind of paths can get derailed, and it's a challenge from a pure practice management perspective to say, because of this, this happens. So a tip I would have, you're looking for specific ideas, is that if this is in your realm, you have to create a way of collecting a repository of your success stories, right? And they're not always going to be tangible production driven, but perfect example is the advisor from Cincinnati I was sharing with you, right? He sent a letter that said, you guys made a huge difference in my business. Is that going to necessarily show up in his production report? No. But you have to start to collect those kind of sound bites and success stories, because over time, I promise you, they will create a mosaic that clearly demonstrates the value of the time and energy that the organization is spending on practice management. So I'll turn it over to you to share some of your thoughts.
Okay, I, you know, have to laugh, Mark. As you were going through the tracking results piece, I almost wanted to, you know, give you the group hug. We in practice management, and you know, by title, I'm a regional director. So this still is a hobby, based on the limited resources that we have to work with. I have one person that reports to me. Speaking of that, this person spent 13 years in the field. He was really the person that ran the office for his brother and father. His father retired. They sold the business. And so the experience he brought to the table for us to take our offering to the next level was invaluable. So I would tell you, from our experience, I would highly encourage someone with field experience to be involved in your practice management role from the home office. As far as tracking results, before I move into my slide, I'm going to share with you, based on our experience, what we feel works. Unfortunately, it's not as fully integrated into the organization, corporation, as I would like. You know, my glasses, as you can tell, I'm a half full, half empty person. I tell you what we're doing, and I tell you where I think we still need to go. What has been, think about the history of, and I've been in the industry 22 years, started at Dean Witter 22 years ago as a producing advisor. What did we used to track in our industry? Well, what do we track now? What are the barometers? What are they? Real quick. Assets under management and revenue. Exactly, GDC. And we used to track new accounts. Remember the old new account contest? Pretty much other than firms like Edward Jones, I think a lot of firms have gotten wise to be focused in different areas. What we believe is a great measurement, because the group hug part is, it is hard to just look at top line revenue and assets and really see a meaningful difference in this work. In many cases, it takes 3 to 5 years to see meaningful differences in those two barometers. However, revenue per relationship and assets per relationship, you should see evidence almost certainly within the first year. And I'll use that to segue into advisor buy-in. I talked about sorting earlier. I don't need to spend too much more time there. Who's your target market? Who do you target? And I will tell you, that is evolutionary. You know, independent advisors, business owners, Mark touched on this. He said big personality. I like the word ego. I'm a big Eckhart Tolle reader. And it's been very helpful to understand and manage their egos as it relates to their acceptance and adoption of education and coaching from the corporate home office. So ego is very important as far as this target market notion goes. You really don't have a choice when you start a practice management initiative as to who you're going to work with. You know, you see in my, if you read my bio, I mentioned that I coach Mark Smith. Mark's, you know, one of the most successful financial planners in the entire country, in the industry. The day we started this 7 years ago, Mark wasn't on the phone asking me for his help, as you would expect. So you're going to have to really work your way into working with larger advisors. How do you do that? Let's talk about a little bit about promotion. We have, as many of you do, really good conferences for our advisors. We have a national conference that is the broadest and deepest in scope. And that, I will tell you, is where we really started to introduce what we were doing. How we did that was, practice management is probably the umbrella of what we're doing to drive results for same-store sales and impact the other areas like recruiting. But there, in our opinion, our experience needs to be a coaching component. We I have five colleagues, so there, our country is broken up. The country is broken up into six regions. So there are myself and five others that are regional directors, and we have assistant regional directors that are our juniors. All 12 of us are registered corporate coaches. We went through a program, and there are several of these programs out there. The one we used is the WABC, the Worldwide Association of Business Coaches. And my email address is my name. That's you see my tent card up here. It's david.patchen@raymondjames.com, so feel free to email me with any specific questions that you have. I'll be glad to provide this information. The coaching part's important because, and I'm trying to weave some of the comments. Dan, you had talked about understand, utilize, loyalty, holding them accountable, getting them to incorporate this stuff into their business. If I were to tell you one of the drivers for us doing this, and me specifically getting fired up about it 7 years ago was, because I've been with Raymond James 12 years, 5 years I spent in recruiting before I moved into sales management. Our conferences are great. Our advisors get jacked up at our conferences, but they go home and they don't do anything, okay? And I see nodding. We all know it's true. There is this huge window of opportunity if we can get them to actually execute. And some of you may know Bob Payne, PSB. Bob and his partners were very successful Merrill Lynch advisors and left there probably 12 years ago now and formed a coaching outfit. Bob, like firms like Genworth, Bob's firm has done some work with us. And actually, it was on the golf course with Bob that I said, you know, why did you do that? Why did you leave Merrill and start your own practice management firm? And he said, well, think about when we did it. It was the mid-90s, and we thought in this IPO craze that we could go public and raise a lot of money, and we really thought we could offer scale through a website. But the fact is, advisors don't learn from websites. And that's extremely important, and it's another reason, two things. The lady in red's comment about technology. Branch staff, in many cases, will and can learn from websites. So it's very important that your promotion efforts are not just targeted at the business owner and the revenue-producing advisors, but also to their support team members. So we have a whole separate track, and we refer to support staff as branch professionals. We have a whole separate track, and there are separate areas of interest on the website specifically focused on branch professionals to get them up to speed, because the fact is, we know the advisor returns from the conference and probably has a huddle, you know, the staff meeting, and this stuff gets dumped on the rest of the team members in the branch. So to the extent we can help them execute, that's really going to be a big driver in seeing this, you know, seeing the results, seeing the benchmarks start to improve. Also, I would mention we now in our conference guide, every session, for instance, this session would have a Q1 next to it, meaning quadrant one. This is a marketing session. This is a revenue enhancing session. It might even have a Q4 next to it because this is a working on your business session. My point is, to the extent our advisors and their staff understand the model, each session of the conference has the quadrants that are addressed in that session notated next to it. So the more we can get advisors up to speed with our model, the more successful we can communicate content to them. Starting small, I mentioned that. Just a little background on how this got started 7 years ago. I did a conference call. We used to have two independent contractor divisions. We merged those divisions 3 years ago. I was actually had national responsibility for one of those divisions, did a conference call to the entire field at that time that I was responsible for. I had them draw the model during that call. And afterward, I still have this email because I still coach this advisor to this day. After that call, one of our advisors, I can even share his name, Jeff Brayton. He is in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, former Edward Jones advisor. He emailed me and said, "Dave, would you help me with my business? I like what you talked about. I like what you said. What could I be a guinea pig?" And Jeff at that time was $175,000 office, so not very big. 18 million assets under management. Most importantly, though, Jeff had a transaction focus and wanted to move toward more reoccurring revenue. His reoccurring revenue at that point was $20,000. I'll use last year's numbers, because last year he was down a bit, as all of our advisors were. But for 2008, he was up to $450,000 in top-line revenue. He was at $300,000 in recurring revenue, and his asset base was just north of $60 million. Now, I have people that have done much faster, progressed much faster than that. So John Vance comes to mind. John is in Valencia, California. And John, I recruited to the firm. He barely made the grade back when our minimum was $125,000. When I started working with him, he was around $200,000, and this was 5 years ago now. John's on track to do about $1.2 million this year. I think the most important part, why I give you some of these numbers, though, is what these, although we have some cases like this that speak for themselves, there are many that don't, but these advisors, to Mark's point, would tell you that the progress they've made in strengthening their business, building the systems in their business, the foundation in their business, the processes in order to replace staff when they need to, in order to retain staff, and also importantly, you know, Mr. Tabergin's here. A lot of our practice valuation work we do, of course, comes from what we've learned from Mark's work in the past with Moss Adams. These businesses are more valuable now. The same business generating the same revenue can be appreciably more valuable if you're working with fewer clients and generating more revenue from deeper relationships. So there are a lot of different ways that you can measure and track success. Not just, as I mentioned earlier, top-line revenue. I mentioned using the conferences as a showcase. Another theme that's really important that we learned, this is like cutting-edge 7-year later stuff to share with you, is in building this site, the best stuff, because we track what advisors hit on the site, the stuff that is hit most frequently is the stuff built by their colleagues, okay? And I see a lot of nodding out there. They like to learn from each other. So what does that mean, and why is what's the late-breaking development? All of our best stuff is from the people that we have had individual coaching relationships with. And that's to Cialdini's book, Influence. That's the reciprocity effect. When I help and my colleagues help an advisor re-engineer their business and they start to see results, they'll give everything they've developed to the Practice Intelligence website. So that's another reason that the coaching piece, along with another one of Dan's comments, was accountability. I will tell you that when we started this 7 years ago, I didn't think they wanted accountability. And as independent contractors, having been an independent contractor, I was very respectful of us almost having a laissez-faire approach and saying, we'll give you guidance, we'll answer your questions, we'll steer you in the right direction. But what's happened, especially as the program has gained momentum and advisors have had results, they now are coming to us proactively and saying, you know what, I need this, and I need you to hold me accountable. And the coaching program, I will tell you, helped us. The training that we all received from the WABC is very, very helpful in building systems and processes around that to have the advisors themselves say what they want to do. Just a little overview. Typically, there's pre-work to be done. There's an assessment that they do for their business. And then we typically talk once a month for an hour on the telephone. Now, the next step is, yes, sir?
When you're, and maybe you'll get to this, but I understand the start small, especially if you're trying to get a program underway. As your program has evolved, have you targeted kind of a narrow band of reps with certain productions, or are you trying to do soup and nuts across your spectrum?
Great question. We will tell you that our sweet spot's probably $300,000 to $800,000 in revenue. Please accept this the right way, okay? And we can say this because they're independent contractors. They're not employees. If they don't have a team, you're wasting your time, okay? Meaning if they don't have an assistant, do not coach them. Make it a requirement for them to get into the program. I've tried it. It doesn't work. They're juggling too many balls. These aren't advisors at Wells Fargo or Dean Witter. These are people that have a business to run. They can't do it all themselves. It's a waste of your time. The politically incorrect part, literally, I use myself. I'm 45 years old, born in 1964, last year the baby boomers. I've got to tell you, people older than me struggle to execute on this stuff because it is so technology driven. So that means they have to, I'll tell you what works really well is we all have these advisors, 55 plus, that are bringing their children into the business. That's an ideal fit. The younger person will develop a relationship with people like myself and my colleagues because they want to change the business. They want to put their own thumbprints on that business. Take advantage of that. So I'm now, I love joking about this with advisors. It's like when I first got into production years ago and, sold some little old ladies out of their CDs and into mutual funds, you learn real quick to sell the risk because you find out later that maybe they couldn't take the risk. I sell all this stuff up front. I'm a very direct person. I consider myself pretty blunt as far as communication at times. I'll have this conversation the first time an advisor approaches me at our conference and asks me, Dave, will you coach me? I will tell them, I will ask them questions. I'm going to do some diagnostic work before I make these assertions, but I'm going to let them know what the roadblocks have been for people like them in the past, and that's been very helpful. One last point on where we're going just this year, and this is region specific to my region that I wanted to share with you. I mentioned this reciprocity principle. What happens is these advisors like to learn from each other, and this is where you use the ego back for leverage and impact. They love helping their colleagues. They get more juice out of it, or as much juice out of helping their colleagues as they do helping their clients achieve their financial goals. So they keep to Mark's point about the letters, there have been great letters written about our progress, but they're constantly saying, Dave, how can we help you? How can we give back? You've done so much for us. What can we do for you? So I came up with an idea this year. Our fiscal year started October 1. We're doing group coaching workshops. So here's what I've done two so far, one in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, one in Houston 2 weeks ago. My next one is in coming up in Dallas. Very simply, it's show and tell. I start with the model. I go quadrant by quadrant. We invite, to this gentleman's point, we invite advisors in that $300,000 to $800,000 range, or others that we're coaching already in the marketplace, and others new to the firm that are interested, because we present coaching during the recruiting process. And basically, when I finish with each quadrant and some of what's working in each quadrant, I turn it over to my star coachee in that marketplace, and he has all of the stuff he's built, his client financial organizer, his roadmap, his pitch book, and he passes that stuff around after our one-day meeting. It's a five-hour meeting from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. We have a partner firm that I have the lead advisor select. So that partner firm representative helps us with the expenses for the day, but also gets to do a presentation at lunchtime. So it's win-win. It's a really good from a relationship deepening standpoint. But what this allows, one of the pushbacks always was, Dave, you can't coach everybody. And, you know, I always said, you know, thanks for that invaluable insight. I actually thought I could coach all 3,000 advisors. However, if you can leverage up what you're doing through your successful coachees, target market, I will tell you, no more than 20% of your field force is ever going to be viable candidates. It's the drivers. It's not the plateauers. It's not the the people that are ready to sell their business. It's not the people that don't have staff. So you can, in my region, a little north of 200 offices, you see in my profile, I coach 40 offices. I have, and my colleagues are gaining a grasp of that good 20% sweet spot within each region and throughout the firm that are worthy of our time and will have results. And I think the other 80% through the website and through interaction with these folks really can find traction for themselves as well. Yes?
I'd just like to clarify a little bit. I heard a couple different things. One is you're talking a lot about talking to the advisors on if they're eligible for your coaching. Also heard some stories on how people at 125 or 175 have grown tremendously. And so is it the 125s or the 175s were new to the firm and they qualified at that category, or was it that you saw something in them that was about their talk with you? What is your communication to the advisors on, talk to me and I'll see how you do? I mean, what's your company stance?
Okay, really great question. Desire is the driver. We still work with, I mentioned that I coach council members only now. Our lowest council advisor is $450,000. But my junior, my assistant, regional director, Kirk Bell, Kirk works with those folks, and I'm involved in those cases. So the answer is we'll still help pretty much anyone that has the passion. That's really how we how we measure. That's real simple. I told you they do pre-work, and we have a first call. You see what happens from that point. John Vance, John's 35. I mean, we started when he was 30 years old, and he's gone from 125 to, like I said, he'll do 10 times that this year. John executed. And those of you know who your people are that execute and get the work done. They're going to have the results. So if they're not executing, it just falls by the wayside. The relationship just fizzles, and they kind of go away. We leave that up to them. Basically, how I wrap up a call is they agree, they make commitments, I use copy talk, and I dictate an overview of our call, and all of those notes come to my assistant. My assistant cleans them up and sends them to the coachee, but there are specific to-dos at the end of that overview of the call. And Tina is tasked with, that's my assistant, with when to call them back, and it's usually 30 days. Well, sometimes I never talk to those people again because Tina calls in 30 days, and, oh, Tina, I'm not ready yet. Another 30 days, ooh, I'm not ready yet. 3 months later. So that's where my comments about age, where my comments about not having assistants, those are generally the people that I've seen that just fail to execute. They're not able to get the work done in order to keep the process going.
I would echo it. It's the people who, if you believe that it's about changing behavior, that takes momentum, and the people who can do that are the people that are trying to solve for something. So if you are making ways available for your advisors to tell you that they want the help, those are the people that you're going to have the results with. The people that are overworked, stressed out, whatever their pain point is, if you have enough communication with them and touch points so that you can be there when they say, okay, I get it, I need to change, those are the people that are going to make that big leap and you're going to have the results with. For us, it's the consistency and how often are we in front of them talking about this stuff, because people are going to come to that at different points in their career. We want to be ready to capture them when they're ready to make that change. And then for everybody else, you know, same sort of statistics in terms of out of the entire population, how many are taking what we're doing and using it. It's a subset of the overall group, but those advisors that still, you know, you have kind of the professional seminar coachy type of people that still show up, they hang out for the 2 days, they feel great about it, they go back, they don't do anything with it, but they still feel great about it, and there is a good lasting byproduct to the organization that you're there supporting them, even though they're not fully engaged in kind of an intense coaching experience. So,
and our next evolution there in our regional conferences this year, what we call, because we branded, our site is called Practice Intelligence, so we now call our regional conferences Practice Intelligence Workshops, and that's going to be the difference this year, Mark, and one of Mark's colleagues at Genworth, Stephanie Bogan, who's a very well-known industry coach, she's one of the people doing the workshops. We're actually going to have soup to nuts three-hour sessions where those of that attend the pitch book workshop, they will enter without a pitch book, and they will leave with a pitch book, because even with the coaching, we're still seeing people not be able to execute when they return. So we're going to do our best to help them go from start to finish in these sessions.
All right, I think we got one last slide here, and obviously, whoops. Want to leave some more time for Q&A. I guess from my perspective, from a suggestions as you kind of embark on what ever you might be embarking on, is that you want to make it a cultural thing. It really needs to be, if you're going to have lasting success in practice management, it truly needs to be a top-down sort of approach, and you need to have buy-in. For those of you that are struggling at getting the buy-in, the best ally you have in getting that buy-in is advisors. So taking Dave's comment of starting small, which is a great way to do it, you start small and you get a couple success stories from some of your best advisors, and they catch the president of your firm at a meeting, and they're saying, hey, look, this is the greatest thing that your organization has ever done for me. You will convert kind of naysayers and doubters. Use your advisors as an ally in getting that buy-in. If you don't have it, hopefully you do have it. A little thing, I'm a huge believer that advisors have to have skin in the game. You cannot give this stuff away for free. Most of the organizations I've been a part of do not view practice management as a revenue driver, but you have to have some skin in the game. If people want to make a change, you want to hold them accountable, one of the best ways to do that is to make them spend some of their hard-earned money to participate in what you're doing. And I've seen a lot of different things work. I've seen, you know, to me, I'm now at kind of the extreme where I want them to pay, and I want them to realize that they're not getting that money back. They're paying for a service and an experience. I've seen a lot of broker-dealers who will say, you know what, coaching program's $3,000 a year, and if a year later your production is X or Y, we'll give you the $3,000 back. You can do that. It works, and it can get kind of people on the bubble there. But me personally, I'm a big believer that they have to have the skin in the game, and that skin should not be a refundable skin. Consistency, I've talked about enough. Leverage to me is a big thing. So broker dealers are a thin margin business. I know the challenges that you have in your organizations, you know, running these things. These programs aren't cheap. You have to be able to leverage your third party firms. And there are a lot of firms that are now starting to do stuff in practice management. Some of them have, you know, more resources or less resources. They are there for you. And this is counterintuitive in the role that I am in today, but having been on your side of the shoes, the one thing that I will say is that you have the right to leverage those resources and to package those resources to be broker-dealer specific. Obviously, sitting in my side of the room, I want us to go out and promote Genworth as much as possible. But in your situation, in your role, you have the ability to create a structure and to create packaging around your offerings and then force your third parties. Force is such a strong word. Then my relationship management people are going to come back. Encourage people to fit their content into that packaging. Right? This is your organization. This is your brand. These are your resources. You're trying to foster that relationship. You can do that and leverage the third parties that you're doing business with. It's a big thing. I'll echo, I took a couple notes and just echo things. The adoption and getting the staff buy-in, it's a huge one, right? Have offerings that get the staff engaged, because that will help to drive adoption and it will help change behavior, because for many of, especially our successful advisors, the real work is being done underneath them by their staff. You got to get them going. I think one last thing, and then we'll open it up to questions. Is the interaction piece. Again, we have seen a ton of success, echoing Dave's comments, that the more you can get your advisors engaged in the process and sharing with each other, the better of an experience is going to be. I shared with you that we do 10 2.5-day workshops. The main reason we do a 2.5-day workshop is that it forces them to have sit-down dinners two nights in a row with each other. And the interaction and the networking that takes place in those types of settings really is the glue that makes those meetings such a success. Now, I'll caution you, because I have done this before, where you have to do a very good, thorough due diligence of who you're asking, what they're going to present, and you have to have them coached up. Because early on, we've had some advisors come into the process, and it turns into a 90-minute, let me tell you how great I am situation, and the people sitting in the room walk around going, God, dude, that guy's ego is insane, and I didn't learn anything, right? So you have to, and I would say you hold third party, your partner firm, to that same level of diligence, to where you need to review content. If you want to have them go through a dry run, you can ask them to go through a dry run. You want to make sure that that's tight. But I will tell you, in any sort of practice management session, less time presenting, more time interacting with their peer groups, and they'll walk out of there thinking it was like the greatest thing that they've ever done. So some of my tips. So I think we have...
And their willingness to share. That's something that we built into our conferences 35 years ago through top advisor sessions. So we have a firm culture in the Raymond James independent contractor space of our top advisors sharing what works. So some of you, if you're starting from scratch with that, that's a process. Be prepared for that. Because if people say, you know, I back in the wirehouse, we had a guy who was a 401k specialist in my Dean Witter office. And let me tell you, that door was closed, and he wasn't sharing what he was doing that was working. And he wasn't sharing it on purpose. So if you have any culture like that, barriers have to be broken down initially in order to start to build some momentum. Yes.
So we have sometimes a reverse problem to that, the not share. We've got several, and they're often our top reps, each of whom thinks they're going to be the next Ron Carson.
Right.
And I don't mean building a $10 million practice. I mean being the guru,
right,
and wanting to be the guru to our reps. Have you encountered that, and do you can't tell them no in the sense of a flat-out no, because some of these guys are our biggest producers.
You can.
How do you deal with that?
Okay, great question. First off, what we tell them is they're more than welcome to promote their wares to their colleagues on their own. We're not going to promote them from a corporate standpoint. That helps. Most advisors don't want to buy stuff from other advisors but they're willing to share with each other. So these, when our top advisors have done it, and what's happened is, I mentioned Mark Smith. Mark Smith put together a program called How to Build a 20 and Build and Manage a 21st Century Wealth Management Practice. And he charged $2,000. It was a two-day program, and he donated all the money to charity. We did help him promote that program because it was something that our advisors wanted him to do, and that he was donating the money to charity. Van Piercy did the same thing. And we have one other advisor that has, actually two, that are trying to build programs that they're trying to promote on their own. So, and I will tell you, I try to talk them out of it, because I say, if you're lucky, you'll get 15 people to buy this program. How much money is that? $30,000? You know, when it's a top advisor that's doing, you know, Mark Smith, Van Piercy, $5 million a year, they don't need $30,000. So if you really restrict it to top advisors, they will self-select out and say, my goodness, why do I? Really, it's full disclosure, and they figure out probably not something they should be doing.
Part of it, I think those are both great answers. I think the addition is it's the diligence in asking them why, what's their driver for it, what's their end game, what's the motivator, and trying to pull back to their production and to show them that it's not going to change their lifestyle given where they're at. It's a huge driver. Other questions? Well, just to add on that, the one thing that I've always been amazed about is that the bar is typically fairly low in terms of what an advisor will think is amazing. So,
unless they create it, because there is a little bit of ego.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think my only fear in hearing how you're kind of positioning that is there's a potential finality to a pilot. Right, and the concept of a pilot is we're going to test it and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, then it's going to go away. And my experience has been, it takes time for the success stories to build. So if the pilot is a 3-year pilot, that would make sense to me. If it's a 6-month and let's see how it goes, I would be worried that you're not going to see the results that's going to generate the desired outcome that you want.
It might be a 1-3-year pilot because the toughest part about practice management adoption is the actual broker dealer who has to. This isn't for us to move the needle tomorrow. This is for us for a long term.
That's right.
Needle. If everyone thinks there's going to be an immediate result, it's probably one of the reasons these programs fail, because the organization itself runs out of patience for this.
That's right.
David, just a comment, Charles. I liked your acronym, refine, consider, delight, refine process. Just curiosity, though, you didn't talk about it at all. Seems in this industry, a lot of the advisors just get stuck. And maybe practice management coaches with the first one. How to find? I think the industry has recognized that rainmaking has become very difficult. Finding the clients to refine, to give a great client experience, to give an investment plan. What kind of program do you have on the client side? Because it's probably the toughest nut to crack, and it is the beginning of the process.
Great question, Craig. What will advisors tell you? You know what? I'm gonna cheat and give you a little tip my hand a little bit. 2 years ago, if you asked an advisor how were they finding new clients, what did they say all the time? You got it. You asking your clients that, or your advisors that today? How many of your advisors are getting tons of client referrals? Let me tell you, your liars are the ones that are. Very few are. Okay. I'll tell you who is the ones that did hands-on discretionary tactical asset allocation. Those are the only people getting referrals right now. I know, I'm in branches.
I would have to take issue with that. I think it's any advisor of any discipline who was in close touch with his client, including the ones that stuck with modern portfolio theory and As long as they didn't hide.
I want to be clear, Mark Smith, who I keep referencing, his modern portfolio theory has not changed. But I'll tell you, Mark's not getting referrals right now, only because clients typically refer when they're making money or when they've made money. And we have comprehensive planners that can tell you times, well, earlier in the decade or the new millennium, modern portfolio theory advisors did so well because they weren't tech heavy. But I will tell you right now, since we had this catastrophe, I have never seen, to Craig's point, Matt Oxley's workshops, he's selling out. We've never seen more seasoned, mature advisors focused on find than right now. 22 years, this is just my perspective. So I'm going to tell you, it's not that they can't get referrals or they've blown it. I don't want to, for goodness sake, most of our advisors are CFPs and MPT people. So, but I'm telling you, I'm visiting them and they're saying, Dave, I'm not getting referrals anymore. So what do we do about that? And, you know, the quadrants are interactive. So a lot of what you need to do to drive quadrant one is to package what you're doing to delight in quadrant three. And really the biggest, and I know we got to wrap up, the biggest area for improvement is to really get your clients to understand what you do for them. We think, we, our advisors, think the clients understand the work that they do for them, and for the most part, they don't. So real quick, it's a great question to have your advisors ask their clients to try and identify this learning curve or this learning opportunity with their clients. It comes from Ray Sclafani, another industry coach. During their annual review meetings, have the advisor ask the client, if you were to describe the services that we provide you to a close friend or family member, what would you tell them? And advisors are learning so much from that question. And when they're learning, when they're hearing, well, I like you and trust you, they know that they have a lot of work to do to educate that client so the client really can identify referral opportunities and tell the story better for the advisor moving forward. So I'd be glad to, both of us will be glad to grab us anytime throughout the next couple of days, and we'll be glad to dig deeper if you'd like.
And I have the same email methodology, mark.schoenbeck, Genworth.com.
Sign of a great session is that we can't end on time, so we really appreciate everybody's attendance here today. Want to offer a special thanks to our panelists. You guys did an outstanding job, so really appreciate it.